What I'd like to start with is first to give you an overview of where inverse problems fit in science and engineering. And we could give this a metaphysical subtitle, Understanding the Unreachable. And so it'll take us at least me, it'll take me a little bit to get used to the three-hour format. I guess I'll aim to go for 50 minutes, then have a 10-minute break and so forth. But the break will shift depending on the subject matter. So roughly, the second main topic for today will be Calderon's inverse conductivity problem. So I apologize to those of you who heard me talk about that last fall. And then I want to spend a little bit of time to discuss further directions or further topics for the course. So part of the reason or at least the excuse for not giving you a syllabus, is that the syllabus will depend to some extent on what you're interested in. There are many directions in which to go, in which one can't go. So when we try to, as scientists or engineers, when we try to understand or see, let's say, inside the Earth or inside your body or inside the atom, so situations where we cannot go in and make direct measurements, what we do is we figure things out on the basis of their effect on waves. And that's, roughly speaking, the subject of inverse problems in partial differential equations. So you are all solving an inverse problem right now, at least those of you who are looking at me. In general, we see by analyzing an object's effect on a wave, which is light, the light wave. So there's a source of light. It bounces off me, and from that bounce off, your brain collects the reflection and analyzes that in reproduces my image. Apparently, a big chunk of our brain is devoted to that problem. I've talked to people, and they give various estimates. At least a third of, and we know it takes a baby quite a bit of time to get all this hard wiring figured out. For any other kind of waves, we're not hardwired to do it, and so we use math instead. So for instance, if we want to look inside the body using ultrasound, we're looking at acoustic waves. Waves in general, as you all know, are modeled by partial differential equations, and that's why inverse problems is an area inside PDE. So if you have a small amplitude, it turns out to be appropriate to use the linear wave equation. So U of T and X is the pressure at time T and position X, and C of X is the sound speed. One usually makes assumptions of the type, let's say C is bounded below and above. So what is a forward problem? Is, for instance, the famous Cauchy problem for the wave equation, given, say, U at time 0 and du dt at time 0 show existence and uniqueness of U satisfying the wave equation and the initial conditions. You might also give boundary conditions. Let's say U of time T and X is F of TX for X on the boundary of some domain. So here you know the equation, and you try to figure out things about the solution. Existence, uniqueness, smoothness, propagation of singularity. Stability in the sense that if we change the initial data a little bit, what happens to the corresponding solutions and so forth. In the inverse problem, here we know, so maybe I should let's say we know we don't know C of x inside omega. But can measure, let's say, in addition to ftx, for every ftx, the wave u on the boundary. So we already know u itself, so let's say we measure the normal derivative of u on the boundary. So we give ourselves, or we obtain from physical situations, additional information about the solution. We want to determine C of x. So I thought I should, let's see, which one activates the screen? I thought I should show you what this entails, since a picture is worth a thousand words. I'll show you two or three pictures. Stop. Okay. Yeah, there's another one there. The other way? Right. So for years I've been working with my friend Professor Wag, who is a terrific acoustic engineer, and the idea is to try to build the next generation medical ultrasound machines. The current ultrasound instruments that are used in a doctor's office have a very rudimentary, I mean, there's almost no mathematics. I can tell you sometime how they produce their images. And the images are pretty good, but they're not good enough, for instance, for detecting breast cancer. So, and they're based basically on geometrical acoustics, travel time to discontinuity and back. So we thought of moving from that to waves, therefore using the wave equation. So this is, of course, an experimental setup. One can imagine using it, for instance, for the breast with some kind of belt of transducers. What you have here is a cylinder with water inside. All this gadgetry is to put in the object we're trying to image. And over here, all around on one section of that cylinder, we have 2048, imagine the soldering job, transducers. So what that means is, think of them as 2048 little gadgets that can send and detect sound. And so I think this is the finest ultrasound instrument in the world. And I thought I should show you the kinds of data that come out of it. So this is for what's called a tissue, a phantom, a tissue mimicking object, which is itself a cylinder. In which there are some other cylinders which we're trying to image, and three wires to give us an indication of how fine the resolution of our reconstruction is. And so here, on the vertical axis, you have in fact 2048 little lines. In this case, they're indexed by the degree. And so what this is telling you is that if you're sitting at transducer number such and such, and then look as a function of time what comes back to that transducer, right? You get a so this is the, if you wish, UTX for that specific X as a function of time on a grayscale level or pink scale or whatever this is. And so you see part of the technical achievement is that there's a huge 100 dB scale here. And so we are able to detect think of this as a wave that comes in from trying to look like a plane wave, hits some of these things, right? And then we get the, so this part is the incident wave. Try to subtract that out. So suppose I'm sitting here. First I hear nothing, and then I start to hear the echo from the big cylinder that's coming back here. Something like that is probably the echo from the back wall of the cylinder when the, okay? And then there's various echoes from the wires, but interestingly, a lot of multiple scattering effects. So a wave will come, will hit this. This then acts as a new source, which starts out another new wave. That hits there, and it comes back here. And this looks a bit similar, if you've ever seen a seismogram, to what people use to when they send acoustic waves to detect oil down below the surface of the Earth. Okay? So when I say a picture is worth a thousand words, we're supposed to look at this and from that determine this. That's the object. This is what you measure. This is what you measure. You don't know that. From the right, you want to get the left. Right. So in other words, mathematics will allow us to see with our ears. And just to brag a little bit, this is the reconstruction, sort of state of the art, with an existing medical instrument. And if you've seen pictures of ultrasound pictures from the doctor, you know they have these speckle patterns that bother people a lot. You also see that the inside cylinders, which actually in this case are made of, so let me tell you what's in these cylinders for a few moments. I should say, by the way, today's lecture is not typical of the rest of the course. This is going to be a pure math course with proofs and spaces and so forth. but I'm trying to give you an overview of where it fits in. All right, so the cylinder is made out of graphite that has about the same sound speed as human tissue. Inside there are two other cylinders which are also made of the same material. Now, in between, we have sprinkled very fine glass powder to create these little scatterers, which explain some of the fine lines you saw in the forward picture. So what happens is, since there are no scatterers in here, the existing ultrasound instrument, who just looks at one basic reflection, doesn't see anything in here. And this is the reconstruction made with our inverse scattering method. I'm now going to show you what happens when you cut across this line to give a quantitative version. This is the conventional B scan, which gives you essentially no quantitative information about the speed of sound. And this is our reconstruction, which maybe you missed this. This line goes through two of the wires, and here they are, and this is the background sound speed. And so you see that the sound speed in here is correctly reproduced as opposed to there. So in breast cancer, there are these so-called microcalcifications, which denote the presence of an incipient tumor, and they can't be seen because of the speckle pattern in current ultrasound. So our hope was that if we reconstruct the speed of sound in a quantitative high-resolution manner, we will be able to detect such microcalcifications. So let me just flash this back again for Adrian. So these are measurements of basically the wave equation in a water tank for ultrasound waves as they hit an object like this. And the idea in inverse problems is to go from this to that. So that's one example of inverse problems. I'm done with the high-tech part of the course. So this in the time domain is a hyperbolic PDE. if we go to what engineers call frequency domain, so that roughly we take a Fourier transform in T, then we get an elliptic problem. And the methods are very different. So most of the beginning of the course, at least, will be on elliptic inverse problems. So one option for later, which I wish you would should consider, is to talk about hyperbolic inverse problems. Let me mention, in case I don't go back to that, that this uses some results from control theory. And the rest, so the hard result on which the whole hyperbolic theory rests is a unique continuation theorem. Of Daniel Tataro. Okay, so let me continue with the list of applications. So you've seen in medical imaging, there is ultrasound. There's X-rays. Now, X-rays were in fact, computed tomography using X-rays was essentially the first time serious mathematics was brought into medical, computed reconstruction of images was brought into medical imaging. So this is a linear problem. Typical of all the problems we'll be discussing is that even though I've written down a linear PDE here, the dependence of the solution U, hence the measured data, on C is highly nonlinear. So the problem is linear. The forward problem is linear in the sense that if you, let's say, double the initial input, right, you double the solution. But if you double the speed of sound, you're not doubling the solution. Or if you add them up, the solutions don't add. So intuitively, X-rays have a lot of energy, and so they propagate along straight lines. And so you use, in things like the Radon transform, you use linear methods. Ultrasound has much lower energy, which is one reason I like it. It's, actually does a lot less harm to you as it goes through you. And it is therefore deflected by the smallest variations in C of X, in the speed of sound of tissue. And so it travels along curved paths, and the curved path depends on the thing you don't know, the speed of sound which you're trying to reconstruct. So it's a much harder problem. Magnetic resonance imaging is based on a brilliant idea of trying to have the hardware select slices for you in such a way that the image the doctor sees is actually just a Fourier transform. So it sounds like the inverse theory here is trivial, and it essentially is. However, there's some very interesting questions about what kind of magnetic fields are best sent in, and perhaps different ways of producing MRI images, which do lead to nonlinear problems. Then there is Calderon's problem, which in the medical community goes by the name of electric impedance tomography. So you may wonder if some of these work so well, why bother with some of the others? And the answer is that each of these modalities picks out different properties of tissue. So it gives you different information about what's inside. So for instance, we function electrochemically, and so information about the electric impedance or electric conductivity as it varies from point to point might tell you things about the heart or the brain, which you cannot see with X-rays or any of the other modalities. So that's when the body you look at is your body. When the body you look at is the Earth, there it depends on what depth you're interested in. So there's a so-called ground probing radar, so here we're talking Maxwell equations, electromagnetic waves. Which goes to about 20 meters depth. And this is to detect buried pipes, mines. There's a lot of defense money in that. More politically correct pollutants, and so forth. If you want to look several kilometers down, to look for things like oil, or water. People send acoustic waves. Oops, I should, sorry, to keep the pattern, I should say here, echo seismology. Acoustic waves. That also works for the bottom of the ocean. So basically the way that's done is there's a truck that makes explosions, sending acoustic waves into the earth, and then the reflections are picked up by so-called geophones. Right, okay, very good. So let's call it, so that's the atmosphere. And then they also use it to go a lot further up to look inside the sun. That's called helioseismology. Oops, wait, I'm not done with you. You deflected me. if you want to go deeper in the earth, so the mantle, this is the upper crust, the mantle is studied using measurements from earthquakes. So there we think of the earth more of as a ringing bell. People make careful measurements after earthquakes of eigenvalues and eigenfunctions for the earth as, and use that to detect, to make detections inside the earth. And it looks pretty dramatic. So for instance, from such reconstructions, which are, I would say, rather crude at the moment, you see things like graveyards of continents. You see how one continent has been buried under the other. And you can see that in pictures calculated from eigenvalues and eigenfunctions of the Earth. Helioseismology. It turns out we have a lot better data from about the sun than we do from about the earth. So there's seismic waves created by convection effects. The surface. So the sun is not viewed as one big ringing bell, but one bell, say that you, the analogy they make is, say you have a bell and you throw sand at it. So there are a lot of little events that make ripples on the surface of the sun. They're measured by Doppler, And they have hundreds of eigenvalues computed, I mean measured, to great accuracy. It is now the somehow the gold standard for anyone who has a model of the interior structure of the sun. So there used to be primitive models which somehow did not fit the measured data. There are now primitive inversion procedures on this measured data, and people who work on the interior structure of the sun test their model against such data. That's right. And they have, right, they have several. So if you just type I'm not an expert on this. If you just type helioseismology in Google, you'll see some very pretty pictures and some very, very well-designed websites. There's one at Harvard, which is. Yes, sir. Right. Very good question. So maybe I slipped there. You certainly don't measure the eigenfunctions inside. You might measure their value at the surface, but I'm not sure whether they do or don't from earthquake data. And then, if you think this is more science fiction, than anything else. There's also, coming back to Earth, there's also non-destructive testing. Suppose you want to find cracks in airplane wings. Without taking the airplane apart, or cracks in nuclear reactors. Again, you send your choice of waves and measure the effect of the object of study on these waves. And since we're going from the effect back to the cause, right, we call that an inverse problem. So maybe this is a good place to stop. And the next hour, I will talk in more precise math terms about Calderon's inverse problem. So we meet again at 11:05. Okay, so let me tell you the story of Calderon's problem, which will keep us busy for the first part of the course. So suppose omega is a bounded domain in Rn. Well, it's New Year's, and at New Year's people like to make lists. So my list will be a list of reasons why I think Calderon's problem is interesting. So the first, before I do that, the first, I don't want to miss this fact, is that, here we're talking about Calderon's problem, Calderon's inverse problem. The first nice feature is that it can be stated without using any math. And here it is. The question is, can we determine the conductivity, leave some room here for making it a little more precise, inside a body from electric measurements at the surface. Now, the way Calderon stated, so this would be a variable conductivity. And the way Calderon stated it, it was an isotropic conductivity. Electric means voltage and current. So in a moment, I will describe this more precisely in math terms. Let me see if I did turn this on. So lovely problem, easy to state, difficult to solve. That's the best kind. Two. Second reason you may be interested in Calderon's problem is that it's important in applications. Specifically when the body is the Earth, or the human body. Calderon had the Earth in mind. I thought that would be a strange thing to do, but in fact it's being done. There are people, pardon me if you've heard this from me before, there are people making careful voltage and current measurements on, for instance, Vesuvius and Etna, trying to determine the shape of the magma chamber. So for those volcanoes, the issue is not whether they will erupt. Everybody knows they will erupt. The issue is how bad will it be when they do. And the shape of the magma chamber has a lot to do with how bad or how big the explosion will be and so forth. There are people actually hiking up Mount Vesuvius and making voltage and current measurements. The problem has received a lot of attention in the medical imaging community. It is the electric impedance tomography problem that I mentioned, where you can imagine having electrodes on your body with some voltages applied and currents measured, or the other way around, currents applied, voltages measured. And from that, trying to find an image of the how the conductivity varies inside your body from place to place. The third reason I like this problem is that, as I hope to convince you in the future lectures, there is a beautiful underlying math structure. So the unknown conductivity, I will call sigma of x, at least for today. And just to advertise just briefly what I mean by the math structure is that we'll define a nonlinear Fourier transform. Of sigma. This thing I called T, and the way we will recover the conduct of the conductivity and the way we'll recover the conductivity is basically in two steps. One will be we'll show the boundary measurements let's say we'll show T can be calculated from the boundary measurements and then we'll show this Fourier transform has an inverse. So we can invert to obtain sigma from T. This is in fact, my entry point into this business. I grew up loving harmonic analysis. Then fell in love with the idea of nonlinear harmonic analysis, right? But rather than just sit around and think, well, you know, what should nonlinear harmonic analysis be? This problem is a very good guide for leading to something that has both a beautiful structure and is useful. Now, a fourth reason before I forget. Is partly historic. People were worked on this problem before they worked on others and figured out it was a breakthrough in trying to solve some of these inverse problems which had been unsolved for years. So if you happen not to believe in electric impedance homography, that's okay. Reason number four is that this is a paradigm for the solution of other inverse problems. For example, it has been done for Maxwell equations. For something I haven't talked about yet, which is the equations of elasticity. There are analogs for parabolic equations. And so forth. Okay, so the list here is by no means exhaustive. It's supposed to suggest to you that there are lots of applications, more than I know about, to inverse problems. And in many cases, different applications require different waves and therefore different partial differential equations and therefore different mathematics. So let's see a little bit. So I will continue this list once we have the mathematical formulation down. So here we have a bounded domain in Rn. We assume the boundary is Lipschitz. Lipschitz function. Now, if sigma is the conductivity and U is the electric potential, then minus grad U is the electric field, let's just ignore the sign, so sigma grad U is conductivity times the electric field. Which is the so-called current density. This is a basic constitutive relation. It's basically Ohm's law. Right? V over R is current, grad U is the voltage drop, sigma is conductivity, that's like 1 over resistivity. And in electrostatics, if there are no sources or sinks of current in the body, right, the current is divergence free. And so we get the standard partial differential equation for the electric potential. So suppose we place a voltage F on the boundary. Then this is a standard Dirichlet problem. Standard Dirichlet problem. So maybe I should state a theorem about what so the basic theorem. No, electrostatic means that the electric and the magnetic field do not change with time. Well, if you look at Max, so in some sense these are two different things. For any vector field, if there are no sources or sinks, we say, I mean, that's sort of by definition divergence free. Right? The divergence picks up sources or sinks for that. Okay. So if you believe there are no sources or sinks for the current, then this should be true. Now, if you don't believe that, you can go to Maxwell's equations, where you will see that in electrostatics, the curl of the magnetic field is J. So J is the curl of something, therefore it's divergence free. Okay. So if there's things depending on time, right, then they come in here. Does that answer your question? Right. Right. So these are two different things to convince you that the divergence of J is zero for us. Yes. That what?
Is that in vacuum?
Right, I think that's for sigma constant. Right. So this is the variable coefficient version of the Poisson of the in fact such a sigma is called I mean, so, such a U is called sigma harmonic.
Jack from Rochelle.
Ooh. Okay, so the forward problem. So omega is bounded Lipschitz domain in Rn. And now let's go more generally from sigma, a real valued function, to sigma, a matrix valued function. So this is a positive definite matrix. So let's assume sigma ij xi xij is bigger than some constant times xi squared. And let's say it's bigger than c naught, c1, almost everywhere. So for every xi in Rn. So for a scalar sigma, this means it is bounded away from zero. And bounded. Why would we care about matrix valued sigmas? Well, I'll put here for isotropic medium, sigma is real valued. Positive function. For anisotropic, sigma is a matrix valued. So this is the situation where the conductivity does not depend just on the point where you are happen to be looking, but also on the direction in which you're looking. So that's of serious practical significance. The heart, for instance, is known to be highly anisotropic. Muscles are anisotropic in the sense that the conductivity along the muscle is very different from the one across the muscle. And I'll come back to that issue later on. But for the forward problem, sigma matrix is perfectly fine. And that's all you need. So then, for any F in the Sobolev space, H a half of the boundary, so for any nice voltage on the boundary, there is a unique solution U in Sobolev H1 of omega, satisfying divergence of sigma grad U equals zero in omega. Well, here I'm saying U has one derivative in L2. This is a second order operator, so we're saying this in the weak sense. And U being in H1 has a trace on the boundary equal to F. And moreover, the H1 norm of U is less than or equal to some constant f h a half on the boundary. The constant will depend on C0 and C1. Now, what about the normal derivative? So by the way, grad u is a vector, sigma is a matrix, sigma grad u is a vector, you can dot that with the nu. So nu is the outer unit normal to omega. Which exists almost everywhere because omega is assumed Lipschitz. Now, for a general function in H1, this need not have a trace on the boundary. However, if U isn't just a general function in H1, but it's a solution of this elliptic problem, then one can show that this makes perfect sense as an element in h minus a half. And its h minus a half norm is less than the h one half norm of f. Okay, that's the end of the theorem. So last time I taught this course, people felt shaky about the Sobolev spaces and didn't know this theorem, and then we ended up spending the semester proving this theorem. So I will assume that you know this. If you don't, much of the, at least the beginning of the course will make sense to you, but I don't want to spend time on this. Since I do want to get off the ground when in inverse problems. There's also Walter Craig's course, which, let's see who's been taking, is he covering this kind of thing? Yes, okay. okay, and so this allows us to define the operator on the boundary which takes h one half to h minus a half lambda sub sigma f equals nu sigma grad u restricted to the boundary. Yes? Right. So this is the normal component of the current. Sigma grad u is the current. You would measure this. You'd measure the voltage. I didn't say charge. The voltage and the current. Right. And so lambda gamma, engineers would call it the voltage to current map. And mathematicians would call it the Dirichlet to Neumann map. So in practice, some people prefer to input currents and measure voltages. So they're essentially measuring the inverse of lambda, which is a smoothing operator. But the data is essentially equivalent. So this is what we owe to Calderon, is to have presented the problem in this very clean mathematical setup. So the question becomes, Calderon, suppose sigma is isotropic, i.e. equals some number sigma times the identity, so the question that I wrote without math over there becomes, is the map sigma going to lambda sigma injective? I.e. if two conductivities give you the same measurements on the boundary, the same voltage and current measurements, does that mean the conductivities have to be the same inside omega? So this would be the uniqueness question. And so most of the inverse problems I listed start out with basic uniqueness questions. Is it possible from that data given to determine whatever you're looking for? And what's nice about this is that even in the applied community, people care to know that. Before they start doing numerics, they'd like to know that the data is in principle enough for determining whatever we're looking for. Calderon actually asked this in two parts. Part one is this injective, and two, if yes for one, so if yes for one, find a way to compute sigma in omega from knowledge of lambda sigma. So maybe I'll finish the hour by telling you what happens when n equals 1. Just to, as a warm-up exercise. So for n equals 1, the answer to 1 is no. Let's see, how do we see that? So here omega we take to be an interval. The boundary just consists of the points A and B. And so F, the given voltage, is just a pair of numbers FA and FB. Let's write it as a vector. So this is a little toy problem, but you know, it's towards the end of the hour, so let's not, it's a good time to do it. So we want U such that what? Sigma U prime prime is 0, with U of A is FA, U of B is FB. So it's a little boundary value problem. Well, this means sigma U prime equals a constant. So in 1D, the current, right, sigma grad U, the current, is constant. So even if the conductivity varies, inside our interval, the current does not from point to point. Okay, so U prime is C over sigma. Therefore, U of X is U of A plus the integral from A to X C d y over sigma y. That's it. We solved the forward problem. No, we didn't. Sorry. So now we have to check for the boundary conditions. So we have f of a, f sub a has to be u at a. So U is FA plus CAX dy over sigma. So U at B is FA, which is FB, plus CA to B dy over sigma. So that allows me to calculate the constant, in other words, the current, C is FB minus FA divided by that. So that gives you the, this is now the, solution of the Dirichlet problem. Of course, for the non-initiates, let me say, there's no hope of writing down such a formula. in higher dimensions, but that's where the fun is. And so U prime let's see. Right. So what we're measuring is basically C. So lambda gamma of FA FB is by definition not gamma, sigma. Sigma of B U prime B. That's the outer normal derivative at that endpoint, and minus sigma A U prime A. So this is equal to 1 over dy over sigma y fa minus fb over minus fa plus fb. So the Dirichlet to Neumann map in this case, okay, so first of all we can obtain from lambda sigma is this, the average resistivity. Now, if you stop and think about this, it makes sense. We have a wire. We put voltages at the endpoints. And we just measure the current. All it's going to give us is the average of that resistor. It will not tell us anything about how the resistivity varies from point to point. Now, in the process, we've actually solved part three, which is not part of Calderon's initial question, but I'd like to describe it nonetheless. Part three, which is find the range of the map sigma goes to lambda sigma. This is what I call the characterization. In other words, if you give me something you measured, if you give me some operator, let's say from h a half to h minus a half, how do I know if it comes from a conductivity? How do I describe the operators lambda sigma which do? So in 1D we've answered this problem. So it's all matrices, of the form 1 over rho, 1 minus 1 minus 1, 1. Okay, so I will stop here, and in the next hour, I will tell you what's known about these problems in higher dimensions. Again, 12:05 seems to be a good time to meet again. It's like a differential operator of order one. You differentiate once. So in particular, such things have integral kernels, which make perfect sense when x is different from y. So if you don't understand this, you can ignore that. We can just count variables here. So so the data depends on 2 times, if x and y run on the boundary, n minus 1 variables. So intuitively, you think of y as a source and x as a receiver, right? If you put a delta function at y, you would get something which, and this tells you what it is at x. So you measure the source y, I mean, you can place the source y anywhere you like on this n minus 1 dimensional surface, and then you can measure the outcome at any x on this n minus 1 dimensional surface. And n is strictly bigger than 2n minus 1 if n is 1. Right, so sigma depends on n variables. Inside. So the problem is underdetermined. You have, roughly speaking, less data than what you're looking for. N is less than 2n minus 1. If n is bigger than or equal to 3, the problem is overdetermined. And this extra data, in some indirect way, enters into the Sylvester-Woman argument. If n equals 2, the problem is formally determined. Because in that case, n equals 2n minus 1. And we know from one dimension that in formally determined problems, that's where uniqueness becomes exciting. It can break down in somehow discrete ways and so forth. So the argument in Sylvester-Woman does not work in n equals 2. I proved that's the case. Oh, so by the way, here, let me stress, and sigma isotropic is injective. Assuming the boundary Lipschitz, and sigma two derivatives in LP, and isotropic. So the short answer to Calderon's problem is yes. Um, you can determine an isotropic conductivity from boundary measurements. And the way this is proved is by constructing solutions to the forward problem so this is a new family of solutions which normally if you're just studying forward problems you wouldn't think of studying with certain with the property that in certain asymptotic regimes, I will get to that, so that I will explain next time, you can read off the conductivity if you understand, if you're given the Dirichlet to Neumann map and you understand the structure of those solutions. So what I'm trying to say here is the main ingredient in those problems is, so main ingredient new estimates for constructing families of the so-called exponentially growing. This will make more sense next time. Solutions. Yeah, that's why I'm getting to. So as you use heavier and heavier harmonic analysis, you get sharper and sharper estimates, and that allows you to weaken the restriction on sigma. And so there's been a mini industry of so let's say sharper estimates yield less restrictions on sigma. So there's been a mini industry of what kind of sigmas uniqueness is true for. Let's write this down. Mini industry for less and less for uniqueness. For less smooth conductivities, I'm guilty of participating in that mini industry, at least at the beginning. So the state of the art is sigma in having basically three halves derivatives. And this is a paper by Paivarinta, Lassi Paivarinta. Panchenko and Ullmann. But you know, people have tried Pfefferman-Fong inequalities. I mean, it gets pretty technical. Sigma in L infinity is a big open problem. Yeah, I'm talking dimensions 3 and higher. In 2D, Brown and Ullmann proved injectivity for sigma in W1P be bigger than 2. So in particular, that still means sigma continuous. In practice, it's good to have results for discontinuous sigma. And in 2003, Kari Astala and Lassi Paivarinta proved it for sigma in L infinity. Now, the way they did this is using theory of quasi-conformal maps. Of which Kari Astala is a major figure. So basically, the idea is that if U is sigma harmonic, there is a V unique up to a constant. Such that F U plus IV satisfies D bar F equals mu DF bar. So this is a form of the Beltrami equation. Here mu is sigma minus 1 over sigma plus 1. So when sigma is 1, in other words, u, Laplace u equals 0, u is a harmonic function. What this says is there is a v such that f equals u plus iv satisfies d bar f equals 0. In other words, V is the harmonic conjugate of U. So V, we could call V the sigma harmonic conjugate of U. And the advantage of working with F is, as you see, there are no derivatives of sigma here. So that gives you an indication of at least the hope of making a theory which does not require any smoothness in sigma. Okay, so I guess I'm changing the order a bit. Before getting into what this course is going to be about, let me advertise that thanks to the energy of Alex Tamasan, we'll organize a working group on inverse problems. And this is one of the papers we plan to read in that group. So the group will consist of we'll have two or three papers, I mean sorry, three or more papers, which we'll hopefully read during the semester. Tentative time. So let me know if you're interested in that. The tentative time would be Fridays. After applied math seminar. So when's the applied math seminar? 2 to 3? So, you know, 3:30 to 4:30, something like that. And that will be within within the program at Fields. So we'll be checking back from the applied seminar to here. All right. So I was interested not just in uniqueness, uniqueness makes for nice theorems, but and in the math literature, it's mostly uniqueness theorems that you see for many of these inverse problems. But in part two of Calderon's problem, which is to find a method to actually calculate the conductivity from the data. And so I call this the reconstruction. I'm sorry, I should have added that. Reconstruction. So if you make the analogy with the Fourier transform, right? Uniqueness tells you that if two functions have the same Fourier transform, they have to be the same. Reconstruction aims to find something like a Fourier inversion theorem. So, for the reconstruction problem, I already hinted in the previous lecture on how that will go. We'll define this this object T, which is like a nonlinear Fourier transform of the conductivity. And on the one hand, we'll show we can get T from the Dirichlet-Neumann map. On the other hand, we'll show how we invert and get sigma from T. So in n bigger than or equal to 3, that was yours truly in 88. And the proof in two dimensions that I gave was in fact already built around the reconstruction. I didn't say when that was, 96, I think. So for those of you familiar with the Marchenko-Gelfand-Levitan business in 1D, the reconstruction problem takes that as a paradigm. So basically we want to determine sigma from lambda sigma by solving linear integral equations. So it's not just the formula, but the way we obtain this inverse of this nonlinear map from lambda sigma back to sigma is we solve linear integral equations to find t, and then we solve linear integral equations to find sigma. So linear integral equations here and there. T is from a previous lecture, it's this nonlinear Fourier transform of sigma that I'm going to define next time. Well, I don't know, at least I will introduce next time. Right. I mean, you can call it whatever, but yeah, right. It seems to be the case in many inverse problems that somehow the object from which you'd rather invert, the mathematical object, is different from the one that's physically measured. Okay, so by the way, I should mention that the reconstruction for in n equals two dimensions for sigma in W with one derivative. So this is the reconstruction version of the Brown-Ullmann paper was done by Knudsen and Tamasan. So some of the, in fact, some of the observations in Alex's paper made their way into the proof by the Ariastala, Cariastala and Paivarinta. Okay, so now I can tell you at least a little bit what the course is going to be about. So what I want to describe to you is, so first part of the course will be on the Calderon problem in dimensions n bigger than or equal to 2. We'll talk about exponentially growing solutions. We'll talk about this nonlinear Fourier transform T, And relation to the Dirichlet to Neumann map and the inversion form, inversion procedure. And we'll talk a little bit about reconstruction of sigma and its and the sigma d nu at the boundary. Which is a separate little argument. So if we do that, you will have an inkling of the mathematical structure behind the problem that I advertised. And some of the techniques and ideas that that were involved in some of the breakthroughs I mentioned. Now, here come the issues around what to do after we're done with that. So, if it's up to me, what I would like to do in the second part of the course is to study, let's call it, analysis of, oh, there's something else I should add here, which is scattering and relation between inverse scattering problem and inverse boundary value problems. So intuitively, scattering theory tells you what happens far away at infinity. So the measurements are done far away. And there's a way to relate, which is now well understood, the data far away to this boundary data. They're essentially equivalent when the conductivity is known outside a compact region. Okay. So I want to talk about analysis of Schrödinger operators. On hyperbolic space. For beginners. So this is something I want to learn myself. So the thought is to start from the definition of hyperbolic space, talk about the Laplacian on hyperbolic space, and scattering on hyperbolic space for Schrödinger operators, and try to understand the papers by Hiroshi Isozaki. So let me briefly describe what that's about. Suppose you have a domain in Rn. You may as well place that domain in Rn plus. So this is the subset of Rn where the, say, the last coordinate is positive. And on Rn plus, you can define a different metric than the usual one, which makes this into a space with of negative curvature and a model of standard hyperbolic space. Isozaki made the observation that by more or less standard ideas from scattering theory in the hyperbolic metric. So let's call them scattering solutions for the hyperbolic metric. Somehow morally corresponds to the funny solutions, the exponentially growing solutions we use in the Euclidean setting. So again, so a lot of this is vague because, well, we haven't built up the machinery yet. But the idea is that to define this nonlinear transform, we first study some solutions of Schrödinger operators or of the sigma Laplacian that I've been mentioning, which you wouldn't normally think of using if you work on, say, Dirichlet problems and so forth. And what he noticed is that you can obtain equivalent results if you place yourself in hyperbolic space and then use solutions which you normally would think of in forward problems. My feeling is that this whole business is not yet well understood, but that it's well worth understanding because in settings, in geometric settings of interest, where you perhaps cannot write down solutions explicitly the way we do in the Euclidean setting, this might give you a way to think of this in a nice invariant geometric way. So that's my proposal for the second part of the course. Other things we can talk about are, so other options. First of all, the n equals 2 business, the nonlinear Fourier transform, can be used to solve the Davey-Stewartson system of nonlinear equations. Right, the integrable one. I mean, to integrate it, right? So the to So some of you may be familiar with the KdV story, where the inverse scattering transform is used to linearize KdV. Similarly, the transform which is used here for the two-dimensional problem turns out to be useful, aside from this inverse business, as a tool for integrating a nonlinear system. We can do obstacle scattering, obstacle inverse problems, which I didn't mention at all today, where instead of variable coefficients in some PDE being unknown, being the unknown, you have an obstacle and you're trying to reconstruct it. Or we can talk about the what I mentioned towards the beginning, the hyperbolic methods. And connection to control theory. And finally, something we could talk about which I didn't get to mention is, what about sigma anisotropic? So that's a beautiful story, which I don't want to ruin in 2 minutes. But basically, the answer is this problem is easier in 2D. So this is understood in 2D. Because an anisotropic sigma can be mapped into an isotropic one using what I called isothermal, not what are called, not I call, isothermal coordinates. So I could add here the 2D anisotropic problem and the construction which more or less follows Alfors construction of isothermal coordinates. I should just add that it's a very much open in dimensions n bigger than or equal to 3. Like usual lists for, I didn't plan it this way, but like usual lists for New Year's, I didn't get to complete my list. But one of the great things, which I did talk about last fall, is the connections to differential geometry. Which perhaps I'll mention next time. So even if you care not one bit about inverse problems in practice, what I talked about in the first hour, there's a purely mathematical connection to differential geometry, and I feel, in fact, it's been shown that the fields each help each other, and this connection is well worth understanding and by itself legitimizes the interest in the Calderon problem, at least its generalization to anisotropic sigma. All right, so we have of course, like other New Year's resolutions, we might not even get to a second part of the course. But just to get a feeling as a show of hand of the interest in the class, so let me number the topics here. There's topics number one, analysis on hyperbolic space for beginners. Topic number two, Davis-Stewartson. Topic number three, obstacle problems. Topic number four, hyperbolic methods. Topic number five, construction of isothermal coordinates. So, which would you prefer to see for part two of the course? So, how many people would prefer part two to be number one? One, two, three, four, maybe. Right, but I mean, I can choose for you, but okay, so how many people prefer I should choose for you, in which case it will be number one? What? how many people prefer number two to number one? Okay. Three, I'm guessing nobody. So, okay, one person. Number four? Number four is the time domain problems, control theory, Tartaru's uniqueness result. This is the work of Belyshev, Kurilev, Matilasas, and so forth. Yes? No? Okay, but not... and number five, isothermal coordinates? Well, all these things are interesting. Sounds like we should have another course next year. Okay. So I got enough hands for number one. The rest of you, I promise, will get to love hyperbolic space when we get into it. Yes, sir?
Another question, which is on the related to what's underneath the second part of the course blackboard. You said
Right.
Many problems are open, the problem is very much open.
The problem is, yes. Yes, you see the picture of your brain. So again, remember, different so first answer is different equations, different methods, different solution, different answers. So for instance, if you go to this, if you go to the wave equation on a Riemannian manifold, and you give the Laplace, the Dirichlet to Neumann map for the wave equation, then it is known that that determines the metric up to isometry. So it is well understood. Now, so it's a good question about MRI. You see slices through your brain. They actually have what's now called diffusion MRI, where they claim to reconstruct. In fact, they have strong evidence that your brain is anisotropic, if it's anything like the normal brain. So the corpus callosum is heavily anisotropic. So there they follow, again, MRI can be sensitive to different things. And they can somehow watch the diffusion processes, and they're very interested in anisotropies and claim to map them, at least in that setting. So when I said open in dimension 3, I meant for the Calderon problem. I give you the, so I'll mention this next time. I give you the Dirichlet to Neumann map for a metric. Does that determine the metric up to isometry? Answer unknown.